Thanks so much for tuning into this podcast, produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas. For more information on KUT programs and to support the station, go to KUT.org. And thanks again.
How y'all doing tonight? Woo! Thanks so much for coming out to Views and Brews this evening. I'm Rebecca McEnroy, and this is Death! Anybody out? So, we thought we'd start with a tune this evening because that might be what y'all came for. But we also kind of want to dig into a little bit of the history since you're here promoting a new film which opens on Friday, a band called Death, which is very exciting. Yeah. And to introduce, we have Dennis Hackney on drums, Bobby Duncan, right over here. And of course, Bobby Hackney. So this journey started quite a while ago. Back in the late 60s in Detroit, Michigan, with your brother David Hackney as well. And three brothers starting a band, a rock band. What were y'all listening to? What was kind of the inspiration for this? And, you know, what was life like as kids in Detroit?
Well, you know, we were listening to... Detroit had such a... for lack of a better term, melting pot of music at that time. I mean, we were definitely tuning into the Motown like everybody else was. And of course, you know, by 1969, 1970, the Beatles had made an impact on all of everybody who listened to music. So we were tuned in to all that great stuff, you know, from the Woodstock era, Sly and the Family Stone, you know, Marvin Gaye put out What's Going On, and that kind of changed things, you know, because it took Motown into a new political atmosphere. And of course, you know, we were in tune to all the local rock bands that we, you know, knew and loved and grew up with, you know, like Ted Nugent, the Amboy Dukes, and you know, the Stooges, and Grand Funk Railroad, and of course the MC5, you know, they were like, you know, and, you know, so all those great bands like Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels, you know, we used to see Bob Seger at the Detroit Auto Show, you know, just about every year, and that was his local gig, you know. He had about three bands. He started out with Bob Seger and the Last Herd, and they used to do this hit that was called Heavy Music, and then changed the group to Bob Seger's System, and then later on he became Bob Seger. So Bob was kind of like our, you know, he was like kind of our rock and roll homeboy, if you would, you know. I mean, everybody that, I mean, in every community you knew about Bob Seger. And so that's what we really grew up, that's what we were in tune to. And then, you know, like in the early 70s, of course, I mean, Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin, The Who, and I mean, all those they made a real great impression on all of us, especially David, you know, as far as Jimi Hendrix. When Jimi Hendrix first came out, I mean, you know, David really, I mean, that was his real first impression of serious rock and roll, and knowing that he could do it, and all the antics and the trickery with the guitar and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, and then of course seeing The Who, that changed the direction in our sound. In 73, they came to town with a tour that was called the Quadrophenia Tour. And what was interesting about that is that, you know, that was back in the days of what they call quad sound. You know, we thought that we had this new thing going on, and it was like this real quad sound, but actually what it was is just two speakers in the front and two speakers in the back. But you know, but hey, it was innovative at the time. And, you know, I mean, when Pete Townsend came, he did something to the Cobo Arena that no actor had ever done. I mean, if you were in the nosebleed seats, you had speakers behind you, and there were speakers in front of you. So it was kind of a surround sound type thing, and that really made a big impression on my brother David, and that took us into, you know, this journey of, you know, kind of like just, you know, orchestrated rock and roll. You know, which is what Jimi Hendrix really wanted to, that was his direction that he wanted to go into before he died, so.
And were there a lot of instruments in your home? Like, when did you guys first pick up your instruments, learn the drums, learn the guitar, like?
That was,
like, not initially.
Yeah.
Bobby was the one who had, you know, the real bass. You know, I had a TV stand with you know those little things? You know when you take your clothes to the cleaners and you have those little things on your pants, those little cardboard things? I used to take those and stick a pencil inside of them, and it made a bounce like a drumstick. And then I turned my mother's favorite trash can over, the one that was in the living room, the gold one, don't touch me. Okay, I turned that over and I put two forks on it and it made a snare sound. And then I went upstairs and got the telephone table, which was made out of metal, and it made a great hi-hat sound. So when Bobby had his bass, I had that set up. And David had, you know, whatever he could find with strings on it. And, you know, those were our first instruments. And that kind of impressed my mom so much until, you know, she kind of later on went out and bought us some real instruments.
And what was the idea to start a band? You know, who was kind of teaching you along the way what a band should do, how they should form, how they should be?
Well, the great thing about that is that we embarked on that journey together. we learned kind of together. And we had some good mentors. Like, we had a guy by the name of Dion. His name was Milton, but he had actually traveled with the Temptations as a bass player. So he had some Motown experience. And then there were some other singers and players that we'd hooked up with in the community. David, you know, had a knack for finding all these offbeat musicians. And one of them was a real old guy by the name of Hank. And he was like a blues player from way back. And, you know, he would do stuff like Sweet Georgia Brown and all that kind of stuff. And David would spend hours with Hank playing guitar with him. And, you know, learning the blues and learning blues licks and stuff like that. So, you know, I mean, we kind of embarked on that. He would come home and show us different chords that he had learned and techniques that he had learned. So we kind of went on this journey together. We didn't have any real super formal training. I mean, there was a music store downtown in Woodward on Woodward Avenue called Grinnell's Music. And I think I took about a month's worth of bass lessons. And I just got bored with that because, you know, I was having more fun, you know, with David and our creativity, you know. So we just kind of embarked on the journey together. We all learned kind of together.
And, you know, the youth movement of the 60s and 70s is associated with rock, and that's kind of a departure from your parents. But you guys, you had a lot of support from your parents. And in a way, even the name Death was inspired by your parents, by your dad. Can you talk a little bit about the first band and then when death came upon you?
Well, that was wow. We had first formed after we got out of the you know, homemade equipment, and we got into some, you know, really good stuff after my mother, you know, helped us out a little bit. And we formed, you know, as we were searching for our identity, you know, we was kind of, well, you know, stuck in the funk thing, the rock thing. We didn't know which way we were going to go. So the name we came up with was Rock Fire Funk Express.
Rock Fire Funk Express. Let me
right.
Just, you know.
It included everything. Yeah. Okay. So we, you know, we were kind of, like I said, looking for our identity. And that was a good name, but that was our first name. It lasted for 8 months, 9 months, between 8 and 9 months. And the culmination of that situation was the single that we got now that's put out by Jack White's Third Man Records. And that was the end of Rock Fire Funk Express. Then David came up with the name Death.
And you weren't really too sold on it right away. What was his pitch to you?
Well, you know, I mean, we had, after Rock Fire Funk Express, you know, what had happened was we had immersed ourselves in rock and roll right around 73, but we were still calling ourselves Rock Fire Funk Express, so we needed a name that would go with this great, you know, rock and roll music that we were doing. You know, we just, you know, milled around with a few names, but none of them ever worked. And David, one day I came home from school and Dennis came home from work, and he says, "Hey, I got the name, guys." And we, you know, we'd always rush up to the room. That was kind of our summit area. And okay, let's hear it, you know. We were waiting, and he said it with all the dramatic fashion of, you know, experienced actor. You know, he looked at us and said, "Death." And he said it to us as if we were supposed to immediately embrace it, you know? And we just said, "Oh, man, no, no, no." I mean, you know, and then, you know, I told him, I said, "I think people are going to be scared of us, man." And then, you know, he explained to us, you know, that the concept, you know, and we was talking about, because we were really into the Doors, too, you know, and he had said that he was really convinced that Jim Morrison had the same was convinced that he had the same concept when he named his group The Doors, because David explains to us, he says, "Well, you know, death is the door. That's the door we all gotta go through." And, you know, he says, "Come on, man." He says, "Jim Morrison, break on through to the other side. What else is he talking about? What is the other side?" And so then, you know, he convinced us that with the more or less you know, with the terms that death was real, and it wasn't nothing gory, you know, because we thought he was going to go into the area of like Black Sabbath and, you know, like really being, you know, not, and we love Black Sabbath, and, you know, but we was like, I don't know, man, we're not going to look right, you know, with gory makeup on and, you know, and all that kind of stuff, you know. And so he convinced us that it wasn't that kind of death, you know. And so we were on board. I mean, we became death, and we embraced the concept, you know. And, you know, I mean, he just started writing, you know, his kind of opera pieces and things like that, that it was all about death. And as a matter of fact, like one of the songs that we do that really kind of explains the concept that made it on the For the Whole World to See album is a song, Let the World Turn. Because he came to me and he had been working on this song for so long, and we heard it. And he says, I want you to write the lyrics for this. And he says, this song is about the concept of what death means. And he was like saying, you know, he says how the world is spinning around, and no matter what we do, the world doesn't stop spinning, but you know, things change, and it's like once you go through this change or go through this door, you'll never know what hit you, and you'll be in a whole new realm, and it'll be, you know. And so when I came up with the lyrics, you know, like, and I showed it to him, and I said, well, you know, and he particularly liked the part in the song that I wrote when it says that, boy, you'll be glad when they let you off. Of course, you won't know really where you've been. Make believe in what they think is real. Just tell me what exactly have they seen. And he read those lyrics, and he got up and started dancing around the room and said, that's it, Bob, that's it. That's what I'm talking about. That's it, Bob, that's it. So, you know, I mean, that's how we just learned to love it as much as he did. Yeah.
And it's such an inspirational concept, yet it was a little bit hard to sell to record companies in the 70s as a black rock group in Detroit.
Oh, man.
What were, you know, before we get to the next tune, and we definitely want to take some questions from the audience tonight, what were those conversations like? You know, what were you, how were you trying to pitch your idea, and what were people telling you?
Well, Brian Spears was our guy. You know, he had signed us up to Groovesville Productions, and Groovesville Productions was a production company in Detroit, and what they did was they, you know, they worked with artists, and they had the most notable studio in Detroit was United Sounds Recording Studio, and they would more or less pitch their master tapes to major labels. So he was getting deals. He had gotten deals for the Dramatics. He had gotten deals for George Clinton, David Ruffin, Gladys Knight. He was working on some stuff with her, Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis. You know, a lot of these artists, you know, even Rare Earth and Robin Trower, he was working with. So that was the reason why he signed us up, because they wasn't really alien to rock and roll. I mean, because Rare Earth, you know, being one of the Detroit bands that was with Motown, you know. And, well, you know, the name Death was just a setback, you know. I mean, even Don Davis, you know, and Brian convinced Don that, you know, he says, hey, look, the name is going to be, I know it's a little difficult, but these guys, what they're doing is really something. Brian saw that we was doing something a little new and something different, so he wanted to take a chance, but you know, all the record labels, as soon as they heard the name, and you know, they just turned off, you know, and they would just, he would just, we would get summoned into Groovesville almost week after week after week to get the rejection letters, you know, because Brian wanted to show us that he was working to try to get us a deal and try and encourage us, but you know, all we was getting was rejection after rejection.
Where did you find support during this time? Like, what kept you going and inspiring you after all these rejections? Where did you find support during this time when you were getting rejected so much?
We didn't find no support.
I guess what kept you going?
That's the problem. There was no support, but no, we just kind of. We just, you know, throughout the rejection, we just kind of bundled ourselves together and said, you know, well, you know, the rejection can flow around us or whatever, but, you know, as long as they don't penetrate us, we can just still keep doing our thing. And, you know, it was the early days, so our mother was kind of giving us room to breathe, you know, and I was working at a jewelry store downtown, and Bobby was fresh out of high school, so he had a part-time job working with the housing and urban development downtown, and we would go home at night and practice. And, you know, and then it became like an every night thing. I mean, you know, because we practiced from 3 to 6, you know, and, you know, sometimes 6 meant 6:30 or whatever, but we would always stop before 9. And, you know, the neighbors just could not take it, okay? And the more they complained, the more David turned it up. He was just totally defiant. And when I saw them, when me and Bob saw them coming against David, we would get mad and we would get behind David and, you know, come on, come on, come on, you know, and people asked, well, you know, that's how the music got faster and louder and had more attitude, because it was a fight. I mean, you know, those guys were factory workers. They wanted to watch the 6 o'clock news. They didn't want to hear us.
One last question before the next song. So, you know, sometimes being that far ahead of your time with your music, I mean, were there any moments in the last 30, 40 years when you were like, ooh, that stings, we've done that?
You know what, we never really felt bitter about, like when bands came out, like The Clash and The Sex Pistols and Patti Smith, I mean, we liked all those bands. I think it was really The Clash where me and Dennis first talked about death, and as far as, because what they were doing was they were mixing some reggae with the punk music and the hardcore music they were playing. And me and Dennis kind of said, you know, man, he says, I wonder what would have happened if we'd have done the death stuff like that, you know, and mixed it in with this reggae stuff that we're doing now. And then we look at each other and go, nah. Yeah? Because we had suffered so much rejection that we thought, the minute you say death, forget it. Yeah. You know, and we were really shell-shocked by that, you know, that everybody that we mentioned it to, you know, would, you know. I mean, even our brother Earl used to get a kick out of it when his friends used to ask, so what's the name of the band? He'd be like, hey, call us up and say, hey, guys, you know what? Somebody asked me, what was the name of you guys' band today? I said, Death! And then, you know, like as if, because he knew that the reaction, you know. And of course, David would use it as a weapon, you know. I mean, he loved to say it, you know. Like when people would ask us, what's the name of the band? Me and Dennis would go, okay, here we go. And then David would look him straight in the eye and go, you were with just real, just dramatic form, like, death. And then he'd look at you, you know, to see what the reaction was. Which was usually, you know, just either scared to death or just, oh, man, you know.
Tell us a little bit about what we're
going to
hear next.
Well, this next song, this is one that we did for the whole world to see. And it's a song that... actually, we wrote this, you know, I wrote this song actually because we were at a point, this was right before David took the phone book and nailed it to the wall. And when Dennis told him, we need a record deal. And because we were doing all this music and we had all this music, and so it's like, where do we go from here? You know, and we just mixed that in and that was kind of our theme.
Okay. Where do we go from here?
Where do we go from here?
Death, ladies and gentlemen.
Timeless children with your predictions and flashbacks trying to get ahead. What makes you think I can see you? What makes you think I believe you? Dreams inside my bed. Have you heard the play? Leave me stepping on bravely. Shot has come to pass. All the dreams are crying, all the thoughts are dying. Earth is coming back. We'll
go from here? Where do we go from here? Where do we go from here? All you false pretenders and your freaky contenders trying to be the first. In my own opinion, you are not defending you. You are the worst. You play the world of a curse and you're trying to curse us through they know no bounds. But we wanted to beat us, but we wanted to defeat us. It's only one time around. Where do we go from here? Where do we go from here? Where do we go from
one more before the end of the evening, so no worries. So I want to fast forward a little bit. You know, we've been talking a lot about how the band got formed, but now you have a documentary coming out, you're touring again, and what was kind of the regeneration, the rebirth of the band? What was that like? Wow. Oh, and I'll have you talk into the mics.
Okay. Well, the rebirth was... It kind of really all took us by surprise, to be honest with you. You know, me and Dennis, we had been doing reggae music since about 1983. Because David went back to Detroit in 82, actually, the beginning of 82. And, you know, we kind of had a standoff for a while. Because for about maybe 2 or 3 years, you know, we didn't really want a guitar player. We just wanted David back. And, of course, he wanted us to come back to Detroit. And we had all begun to raise families at the time. Even David, he took his wife back to Detroit with him. So it was really hard for us to, you know, we always thought that he would come back to us. And he always thought that we would, you know, go to Detroit. And time moved on, and then, you know, around 1984, you know, after playing bass and drums for so long, you know, we kind of gravitated to reggae music, you know, and so, you know, because we didn't have anything but the bass and drums, so we got introduced to reggae music. It was a no-brainer for us because we saw how the college kids were going crazy over the bass and drum sound of reggae music, and that was all we had. So we figured that, you know, hey, you know, maybe this is a little something that we can occupy ourselves with until we, you know, until we regroup with David. And as time just kind of went by, and you know, as they say, life happens, and life happened to Death, you know. So we kind of, you know, ended up kind of moving on, you know. And you know, after of course, you know, it was really kind of painful for us because, you know, David, you know, he couldn't really fight with his demons of alcohol and really smoking as much as he did. And I mean, everything David did, he did with extreme passion, including all the bad stuff. But, you know, and it was hard for me and Dennis because we would go to Detroit and visit. And, you know, my wife was from Detroit, so we would always go back there. And David would come back because his wife was from Vermont, so we would see each other, and we noticed that David was kind of, you know, his health was fading. And it was really hard for us even before he died because we knew that, you know, even if we did get back together, that he wouldn't be able to really have the stamina that it would take. I mean, me and Dennis, you know, we had been out on the road with Lamb's Red. We'd been touring all over New England. We did tours and, you know, in the West and in the East and in the Midwest. And so, you know, we were kind of in that groove of being on the road and gigging, you know, kind of night after night. And we knew that what it took, you know, to maintain that. So it really made us sad because, you know, every time we went into the recording studio, even with our Lamb's Red band, and every time we played, every time we recruited a guitar, we couldn't help but to think about David. And so, you know, and seeing his health kind of fade on up until he died, that was really hard for us. And so, you know, it was really, you know, it was a difficult thing to kind of move on. But, you know, we just had to, so, you know.
And I have a question also for Bobby Duncan. You know, you guys were, you got the call to get back together after your son, right, discovered? It was Bobby's son, discovered these tapes of Death. And you got a call to get back together. What was it like when you were asked to join the band, inhabiting such a large spirit that David left?
Oh, wow, it was kind of surreal, I mean, in the end. But in the beginning, I was just coming to rehearsal Thursday night, you know? It's Thursday night rehearsal, and Bob, because I had started with him 7 years ago, so we were playing, you know, reggae and jazz and R&B and stuff, and Bob came down with a CD one day and a story about the stuff you did when you were kids. And I'm always game anyway, so I said, well, what you got? You know, I took it home, and I immediately fell in love with the songs, you know? Had my favorites, couldn't wait to get to the next rehearsal. And was, you know, I was just trying to learn the songs and getting physically ready for it. But then after, like, I started to realize, you know, what David really meant to the whole situation, because they only, you know, Bob and Dennis only mentioned David, you know, a couple of times, you know, because it really didn't have anything to do with what we were doing at the time. But once I got to know what was going on, it was more than just like me, a guitar player, you know, doing a gig, you know, covering parts. It became like, wow, this is something different. This is a whole spiritual, this is something. And plus, also found out that these guys were the originators of punk rock, but he didn't know it at the time, you know. And me always being a person that's always looking for the person that's the originators or the core of something. I read liner notes like there was no tomorrow. And so here I am, I'm running to the original guys, you know. And so I'm like, I'm happy, you know. But I don't know. I mean, I think it's just all a blessing. I mean, what we've gone through the past couple of years, it's been a lot of work, and I've seen these brothers cry a few times, you know, because I get tears too, you know. It's more than just a gig now, you know. It's we're family. We've been doing this for a while now, and I'm just proud to be able to fill the man's shoes and hope I'm doing them well.
And
yeah.
The documentary opens the 28th. There's another screening tomorrow night in Austin. I'm curious, who's seen the documentary? Yeah. Ooh, great. Because we're skipping through a lot of history, a lot of story here, but that's okay because you all, you know, find out what's going on in the documentary. What did you guys think of the documentary when you saw it? What was your reaction? Oh, you got to talk into the mic, though.
Well, Bobby and Jeff Howlett, they had kind of an off and on relationship. They met when Bobby was doing the Reggae Fest. He was the director, and you know, over the years, it got, you know, from 1,500 people in the park to, you know, 20,000 people in the next park and 30,000 people the next year and all the way up to like 54,000 people. But in the early days of that, him and Jeff knew each other because Jeff was in a band and part of another function that he was putting on. And so they sort of kind of formed this relationship, and Bob knew that he was going to school to be a filmmaker. So, but you know, that was back in the early days, so we didn't think nothing of that, and he was still playing hardcore anyway in a band. So over the course of the years, when the death story did pop back up, he was still around Vermont, and by him going to see the Ruff Francis shows, because they were kind of covering our music, he came back and talked to Bob and said, hey, look, man, has anybody approached you guys about doing some film? And well, we had one kind of semi-serious offer that we really didn't go with. But, and we, you know, Bob, I guess, you know, it's kind of hard to take these things seriously when you first hear them, you know, because this is the music business. But, you know, Bob gave him the permission to go ahead and do some first passes. And after he got done with the first passes, we kind of looked at each other and said, yo, man, this is serious stuff. So Jeff, you know, wanting to get really into the total aspects of the story, he literally became a member of our family for about 4 years. While he researched the story, he talked to our relatives, he interviewed my mother, my brother, aunts, uncles, anybody that was, you know, affiliated with the story. And it was him and Mark Covino who really put that kind of creativity into the film to make it what it was.
Did you think when you saw it that it was accurate? Did you want to leave something in that they cut out or perhaps add something?
No, it was, to me, it was pretty much as it was. Yeah. You know, they told the story pretty accurately, you know. Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, in a tribute to Jeff and Mark, especially Jeff Howlett, because Jeff, you know, I mean, when you get involved with these things, you become close. And me and Jeff had countless hours of conversations, I mean, 2-3 o'clock in the morning, you know. And I think what really, it's kind of a one-on-one lesson for being a filmmaker is how to make a great film. We didn't know nothing about making a film, and we're musicians, you know. But what he did was he really got into the mind and the heart and the soul and the spiritual element of my brother David, and he made that his mission. And that was the gateway to open up for me and Dennis, which became the gateway to open up for our whole entire family. And that really shows in the movie, and we're really proud of that. Because, and I told Jeff over and over, I says, the only way that we would do this if David is honored, because we don't want to spin the story any other way than the way it was truly spun. And that was, you know, David's vision. Because we would trade everything that has happened to us, just to have David come back and play one set with us. We would do that. Because this was his vision. And so, you know, we're living his vision, and we're living the vision that we all collectively put together. And it's like all those wonderful conversations we had in the quote unquote room, that's what we called it. That was, you know, that was our place, you know. And so we spent hours there writing songs and going over the music and talking about death and the concept and David used to have some wild, wild concepts about, you know, death, you know. I remember this one time he said that, he said, yeah, you know, when we start touring, here's what we're going to do. He says, at the intro of the show, he says, there's going to be three coffins that come, you know, down, and we'll be in the coffins, and then we'll just pop out the bottom of them. And we'll start playing, you know, and I'm like, you know, and I, all kinds of stuff like that.
It was the 60s, you know? People.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff. So he had all kinds of concepts, you know. And so, you know, I mean, it was him, you know, and he was very, very just so passionate about playing all the time. His hands were literally glued to his guitar. I mean, if David wasn't in the street, he was on the guitar.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that the story in itself and that you're back together really offers a perspective that gives us all kind of some inspiration and an idea of redemption. So I think it's really beautiful. I'm so glad you guys are together.
Thank you. Well, you know, David was all about family. I mean, he was all about our family, and, you know, I mean, the one thing I wished that, and he loved children, he loved all of our children, I mean, and David never had any children of his own, he always told me, he says, you know, my song and my music is my children, and, you know, I mean, he was just so, it just overwhelms us, because, I mean, here we are, and we're kind of taking care of things that he left behind, and we just want to give him the honor, you know, and make sure that he's honored all the way.
Cool. Yeah. Taking care of the kids. I have a wonderful intern out there by the name of Joseph Ramirez, and he has a Rover mic. So if you have a question, please raise your hand high, and he will come right to you. There's one right up here in the front.
Are you playing Fun Fest in Austin, Texas in November? And if not, why?
Hey, we have played Fun Fest. That was actually one of our first gigs, you know, when we came back. And we would love to come back. So you tell the folks at Transmission Entertainment, you guys live here, tell them you want to see us, and we'll be back. We'll be back.
Hey guys, welcome to Austin. Glad to have you here. Hey, I was wondering what you thought about when the Sex Pistols came out and when the Ramones came out and what your thoughts were about them compared to your style.
The ironic thing about it is with the Ramones, we thought the Ramones were great, and Dennis, you know, he loved the Sex Pistols. Maybe a little more than me, even though I introduced him to the Sex Pistols because I was a disc jockey on WRUV, you know, and we used to get all the great records, you know, and we would listen to all that stuff, and we never really thought that we just thought that they were great, and the thing is, my kids, you know, like Bobby and Julian, they were pretty heavy into those guys. They introduced us to the Bad Brains, and they introduced us to Henry Rollins, to the Dead Kennedys. They introduced us to the bands like the Gorilla Biscuits. And I'm like, the Gorilla Biscuits? What are the Gorilla Biscuits, man? And so, you know, Bobby was into all of that stuff, and he and his friends were forming bands. And I used to tell him, I said, you know, some of the stuff you're doing, I mean, we used to be in a rock band in Detroit. And he'd be like, yeah, Dad. Yeah, Dad. You know, and, you know, I mean, the thing was is that the death story was so painful and so rejectful for us, for me and Dennis, that we was like, well, we're not going to bother with you. And at that time, we had moved on to the digital age like everybody else. You know, we were, you know, donning Walkmans and you know, that kind of thing. So here, those tapes were up in the attic. We didn't have a reel-to-reel tape. It wasn't like we'd sit around on a Sunday afternoon and say, hey, kids, let's listen to some Death, you know? I mean, and they wouldn't even, you know, wouldn't even know the concept. And it's just like, you know, when they found out, I mean, it was just like, I mean, the movie really depicted it well, you know, because that exactly was the way when Julian called me up from San Francisco, you know, I had that conversation ended up being like a 3 or 4 hour conversation because, you know, he did ask me, he screamed at me, he says, Dad, why didn't you tell me this? And you know, and I had to explain to him, you know, and then I really kind of gave him a whole synopsis of the whole Death story and what we did in Detroit. And then Bobby called me up and he says, now this explains it. He says, this explains it. He says, you were telling me to cut that music down in my bedroom. He says, and now I know it was in my blood all the time. So, you know, we had those tapes up there, and it was funny because when Bobby had did all that that research on the internet, he called me up and he said, Dad, please, please tell me you have those master tapes for the Death music. And I mean, it was so weird because it was just as easy as I would tell him to go mow the lawn. I said, yeah, they're upstairs in the attic. And he just, I mean, you would have thought he hit the lottery, you know? It was like, he just screamed and yelled like I never heard him scream before, you know? And he just said, Dad, we got a lot of work to do. And so here we are, you know? Here we are. Here we are.
We have time for a couple more questions. Let's see, where's Joseph? Oh, he's going. He's working his way over.
That wasn't my fault.
Hey, I caught you guys at a South by Day show a few months ago, and you mentioned a new album you were working on. You guys still doing that?
Oh, definitely. We're with the albums in the can, it has to be mastered. But you know, Draft House did something, and me and Dennis gave them permission. You know, they wanted to do a replica of the 45 that we put out in Detroit. We allowed them to do that, and it's on the original label and everything. And so that inspired us because David was so passionate about that record and about the label and the concept and everything with the whole record thing. And what we did was we took two songs from the album, and we're gonna have a special limited release on vinyl of two of the songs from the upcoming album, and it'll be in the same vein as the record that we released in Detroit, so it'll look just like that, you know, with the same triangle label and everything, you know? And we did that also. We were thinking about David, because he would love that. He would love that. So next month, July, we'll be releasing that, and hopefully the album will be released before the end of this year. Huh? Yes, we've completed the manuscript. I actually completed the manuscript, and it's kind of an autobiography. And it really, like Scott Mosier, who's the producer of the movie, I sent him, you know, like he was one of the first people I sent a copy to because, you know, I really wanted to get his take on it because they were really in the process of editing and finishing the movie. And he loved it, and he said, you know, this is really a good, you know, it goes hand in hand with the movie, and it does. It has quite a bit of detail in it that the movie doesn't have about our family and about David. Like, for instance, you know, this next song that we're gonna do, there's a story behind it, and it's a story I don't really like to tell because it's so funny. But you know, back in those days, you know, rock and rollers did experiment with drugs, right? And you know, I used to go to school with this big afro and with this, with these mirrored sunglasses and all this jewelry and my paisley shirts and my, you know, platform shoes and my suede pants. And I was really kind of the weird kid in school, you know, because I was looked like this rock and roller. And, you know, these guys, David and Dennis, you know, at the height of their mischievousness, decided one day as I was going to school to put a hit of THC in my orange juice. Unbeknownst to me, so I'm going to school, and all of a sudden the building started to wobble and things were looking weird. And I remembered that experience, and I coined this, I penned this song called Freaking Out based on my experience. And that's the story, and that's one of the stories that's in the book that you know that we didn't tell in the movie, you know. But yeah, they were jokers. They were really jokers.
So right before the last tune, I would like to thank everybody for coming and some people for making tonight possible. Jeff Hoskins is running sound. Thank you, Jeff. Behind the bar, be sure to tip your bartenders. We have Travis Grimmie, James Morgan, Garrett Fulce, and Chris Luak. Thank you very much. From the Cactus Cafe, Amy Chambliss, Matt Munoz, Daniel Berkowitz, and Jack Leahy. Thank you very much. And from KUT, thank you very much to Joseph Ramirez, who has been carrying the mic around, and to Hawk Mendenhall. And tonight would not have been possible if it wasn't for Brandy Fonz and Daisel Armadarsi. I think, I don't know, you know, I'm trying. From Draft House Films, thank you guys so much for making tonight work out. Thank you. Our next Views and Brews. Well, thank you. I love you. Our next Views and Brews is July 9th, and we'll be talking about all the craziness that's happening at the state capitol right now with a special session with Ben Philpott, so be sure to join us for that. Find us on Facebook and check out all the archives at viewsandbrews.org. Also, anything else? What's up? Oh, we'll do a meet and greet out at the merchandise table just after the show. So please stay seated after the show and meet the band outside. Fantastic. One more time, let's give it up for Death! Woo!
And like I said, now you know the story behind this song. And those guys laughed it off. But this became one of our favorite songs. And this became one of David's favorite songs. And it became kind of the signature. When we recorded it at United Sounds, Jim Vitti, who was the engineer, Jim Vitti had recorded for everybody. I mean, from the Rolling Stones to the Funkadelics. And when we did this, instead of counting it off, you know, we decided to just scream the word death. So, you know, like we used to say in Detroit in 1975 at United Sounds,
it's a scheme, it's a thing. Why is my head spinning, running a dream? It's a time, it's a place. Why are these lights popping up in my face? Oh, am I freaking out, 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 freaking out.
sign on the wall. There's a witch with a big crystal ball. There's a eye, there's a heart. That's all the pressure is in the truth the part. Or am I freaking out? Freaking out?
Thanks so much for tuning into this podcast, produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas. For more information on KUT programs and to support the station, go to KUT.org. And thanks again.